Hello, I'm Tony Collins and this is the Rugby Reloaded podcast. This week I'm going to look at one of the most vexed questions in rugby of both codes, the salary cap. In one sense, rugby introduced the world's first salary cap in 1886 when the Rugby Football Union made rugby an amateur sport, therefore effectively capping wages at £0. And this decision fundamentally shaped the cultures of both union and league. Clubs that fought the RFU and then created the Northern Union developed a belief that, in the words of St Helens' great scrum half Alex Murphy, players and clubs felt obliged to see how far they could go to bend the rules in their favour. In contrast, rugby union developed a hypocritical belief system of amateurism, which condemned others for the very things that the RFU consciously turned a blind eye to. And the legacy of this lives on today. You only have to look at the recent Saracens salary cap scandal in English rugby union or the Melbourne Storm affair of 2010 in the NRL to see how far the hands of history stretches. So, to discuss the ramifications of the salary cap, with me today is regular guest, former St Helens chief executive Sean Maguire, who you may have also recently seen on the excellent BBC documentary Once Were Lions. So, welcome back to the show, Sean.
Thank you very much, Tony. A pleasure as always.
Do you think that's a fair reflection of rugby league culture, that everyone's expected to see what they can get away with and bend the rules as far as possible?
Well, I think you said that was a comment from Alex Murphy. And I'd be very, very, very loath to disagree that Alexander the Great ever says.
It's from one of his three biographies.
Ah, right. I remember reading Saints Hit Double Top, I think was the first one that I read. And I think he's probably uttered a sort of basic truism about any set of rules that people don't feel entirely comfortable with because they think that they're probably artificially restrictive.
Yeah, and I think it's something to do with the working class nature of the game, that it's like being at work. If you can take advantage of the boss you're going to, and I think that's also part of rugby league culture, and you know, despite the changes, it remains so today as well.
And I think that the other thing that that's all part of is the way that players were treated, particularly in the old days, by sort of imperious board members of clubs. And you can read in many player autobiographies about some of the really extraordinary ways in which they were talked to and addressed by the people who were then running the clubs, allegedly on behalf of the community. So I think that's deeply embedded in the way that someone like Alex would look at the idea of, you know, as he did on the field brilliantly occasionally, just taking the rules to the furthest extent and seeing what would happen.
Going back in history, that's a nice segue. This is what happened with broken time as well, because before the split, the Northern clubs campaigned for broken time to compensate players for taking time off work. And when the split took place, the very first decision they took at the George Hotel was to legalise broken time payments at £6, which was seen as a maximum. But of course, this was rugby in the North, and people just assumed that that was at the bare minimum of the scale of payments, and players demanded much more than that. And you can see, even in the first few months of the Northern Union, that nobody really was respecting the £6 limit. And so by the time, a couple of seasons in, by 1897, it's clear that it's not working. And the Northern Union have to legalise full professionalism. And one of the things that they did, though, and again, it's interesting, as you say, the way in which the clubs try to control the players, because the Northern Union tried to control professionalism, A, by not paying players during the summer, unlike in football, and B, by making sure that all players worked outside of the game. So you had to have a job if you're going to be paid to play rugby, apart from the fact you couldn't work as a billiard marker or a waiter in a licensed house.
Waiter in a...
Yeah, which yeah. basically being a barman, because I think those type of jobs have been used in under rugby union rules as a way of slipping the players a weekly wage without violating the amateur regulations. So yeah, so this thing's been these things have been deep in the game's culture right from the word go. So it's not surprising that it's Australia's no different either. So it's not surprising that it struggled with notions of salary cap and maximum wages and stuff.
And it starts really, doesn't it, from a very interesting premise, which is to limit the ability of the people who the public want to watch doing their job, if you want to put it like that, from earning their full potential. So this idea of these restrictive wage practices, which is what the salary cap is, really, which is, I think, probably a kind of restraint of trade too, has a long history in the game. And as you said, it becomes sort of embedded in the culture. So people just don't think it's very odd. And when you look back at the early decisions of the Northern Union, why couldn't players be whole time? What was the rationale was to con was because of the kind of union attitude to amateurism, wasn't it? And this sense that they couldn't say you could become a whole-time rugby player. There was something sort of ignoble about that. But you could be compensated for losing time, which is, in a sense, contradictory.
Yeah, because they were kind of... they're always looking over the shoulder at amateurism and the RFU, that they didn't want to really conform to the RFU stereotype of what the Northern Union was, that it was, you know, fully professional game made up of mercenaries who were only interested in winning.
Mercenaries.
Yeah, and so the Northern Union obviously felt that they kind of had to pay lip service to amateurism. And the other thing was that they were, as businessmen, they were frightened that they would end up paying players too much and they'd bankrupt the clubs. But that never happened. And when clubs did go broke, it was more through financial mismanagement or simple economic conditions. Because obviously in the 10, 15 years after the split, in the early 1900s, they were a bad time for a lot of industries in the north. And so the fears that professionalism, that paying players money would lead to the bankruptcy of clubs, didn't really affect them. One of the things that is interesting is that they always rejected the maximum wage, which football brought in 1901. And they had it until, 1961. And so they did reject that idea because on the grounds they knew that people would try and get around it. So that idea, so very early on, the idea of artificially restricting wages through the equivalent of a salary cap, which is what a maximum wage was rejected by the game because they were fully aware of the fact that, again, this point about the culture, that people would try and get around it and they'd found all sorts of arcane methods of covert payment during the rugby union years.
Well, what employer, particularly in those days, wouldn't like to have the luxury of limiting his fixed costs by paying the people who work for him less than they were worth? I mean, that's, I suppose, you know, that and amateurism, as you say, this great sort of... The game had an albatross round its neck about amateurism because of rugby union setting the tone and being able to use words like mercenary, and they somehow weren't the kind of chaps who should be doing it. And the quote, Tony, in rugby's great split about the rugby union official, was it Frank Marshall, who said that if the working man can't afford to play rugby, well, he shouldn't play it. Thank God we destroyed that idea in 1895. But the idea of the salary cap as its modern sort of manifestation in the game now, I think, is a massive issue which is connected to many other of the fundamental problems that the game needs to look at and review to decide where it wants to go and what kind of sport it's going to be.
Yeah, because it's similar issues. Because one of the things that struck me when I was doing a bit of research on the salary cap was that the current salary cap, which is what, £2.1 million, I think, at the moment, the current salary cap is actually half of what Wigan's wages bill was in 1996. So wages for rugby league players have actually been depressed over the last 25 years. And I know that there's also been research done on this in Australia. And when you take inflation into account, the wages of rugby league players in Australia have also gone down as well. So you can see it is actually used to suppress wages and basically get players on the cheap.
And the problem with it, I mean, one of the things I think that people probably don't realise about the salary cap is, and I think you made reference to it in the past in its original kind of manifestations in the Northern Union days, is just how much effort from the central body it takes to invigilate and manage and police something which is almost the kind of internal club semi-accounting issue. So the resources that Rugby League now devotes, certainly when I was at Saints, I remember the scale of them to managing the salary cap and the salary cap auditor turning up, etc., was diverted a lot of attention from very serious structural problems that need to be dealt with just to conform to the salary cap, to make sure that, you know, that some of the rules are really quite specific and that they're more of an accounting basis, how you treat things like national insurance payments for players, what are legitimate expenses for an overseas player relocating. And what you get, of course, is this culture, really a bit like taxation in a modern economy, Tony, for companies, where you kind of encourage smart alecky kind of evasive tactics, which aren't avoidance, a bit like taxation. You know, you can avoid paying tax, but you can't evade it. been more litigation about than any. And I think it's the same with the salary cap. And it simply, it encourages a certain degree of furtiveness. I think that's inevitable. But in my view, its greatest flaw is that it is part of a whole sense that the game isn't going anywhere. And that instead of having its eye on expansion and looking at the serious questions of where it sits in British sport, that it will continue to, as was recently proposed, I think was it 2017, that the salary cap should actually be cut.
This is one of the issues with it, that it's actually been used as a way of, in a sense, depressing the whole game, that it's undercutting the game's ability to compete either with the NRL, and more particularly with the rugby union. I mean, I think one of the things that's often forgot about, one of the problems that the game has and has had since rugby union went professional, is the fact that with one or two outstanding exceptions, by and large, the number of players coming from Wales has almost dried up. Not completely, because there are some great players who've come up. But in terms of getting the headline players from the Welsh national side, which was a staple of the game for a long, long time, and South Wales was almost like part of
an alternative Heartland.
That's
almost,
right. Yeah,
it was kind of
a semi-detached part of the Heartland, I suppose you could describe it. And that's been lost because we simply can't compete, because it would be difficult enough anyway, but we're kind of competing with one, if not two arms, behind our back with the salary cap.
Well, I think that's what I mean about the salary cap having a much wider effect merely than being a kind of, a kind of financial management matter for the individual clubs, because it's a sense of the game showing no ambition. And if you've got a salary cap, emphasize, what is it, as you say, 2.1 million, one of the problems might be, and I think there's a lot of discussion amongst fans about this, that we don't have any heroes, there are no role models, there are no outstandingly famous players. You know, when you look at Ellery's probably still one of the most famous English rugby league players. I mean, none of the guys who played in the grand final, with the possible exception of Sean O'Loughlin and James Graham, for really other reasons in a way, most of the other lads would be unknown, even outside their own small communities. We don't have any stars in the game. And one of the things I think that is inextricably linked to is what the salary cap represents about our sense of ambition and where we think we're not going to grow by lowballing Tony. That's not going to work for rugby league. We'll just sink into a very much more difficult position, in my view. And I think it also brings up the other question that it's linked to is the management and ownership of individual clubs, because we need to attract people who want to invest in the clubs that they own and run, because they want to grow their revenues, and they know that the way they've got to do that, like in most other enterprises, is to invest in them in all sorts of different ways. And one of them is by buying the best players they possibly can in an open competitive sports marketplace. I've never seen anything wrong with it. I mean, besides those deep questions of where the game is going, there were two other justifications, weren't there, that were popular. One was that the salary cap would maintain solvency in all clubs. And I think that myth has been blown sky high. And the second one is it will produce a more level playing field in the Cubs in the Premier competition of the Super League. How many teams have won Super League, Tony, in the last quarter century? Four.
Yeah, there's only ever been four winners of the Super League title. And that makes, leaving aside the Scottish Premier League, which obviously is a case on its own because of the dominance of Glasgow, it's the most uncompetitive major sports league in Europe. Even La Liga in Spain, which is dominated by Barcelona and Real Madrid, have had more winners of the La Liga title in the same period than what we have. This is one of the problems. It's kind of everybody repeats the same mantra about salary cap. It protects clubs from themselves. It maintains competitive balance. In some competitions, it does. I mean, in Australia, obviously, it's rare for a club to win back-to-back premierships in Australia. But in Britain, that's not been the case. And I think it highlights the fact that we really need to have a much more critical view of the role of the salary cap and what its purpose actually is. And I think we've said this before when you've been on the show, that we need a balance sheet. We need some accountability of what the results of this policy have been. Unlike you, I think if you look at the two key aims, the two key stated aims of the salary cap, and this is true not just in rugby league, but in every sport, in terms of competitive balance and in terms of the economic health of clubs, then it's clearly not worked.
It hasn't worked by its own, but as you say, by the two reasons that were promulgated by its keenest fans as being the justification for having something, which I'm pretty certain, if it were ever challenged, would collapse like a house of cards. It's a blatant restraint of trade, and I think it's not serving any purpose at all now. I think it's getting a lot worse because the game, I think, is at a very important juncture. There are opportunities we can seize. Anyone who's familiar with the debate that's raging through rugby union at the moment knows it's having a very difficult time. Even its most passionate advocates are saying that it's about as much fun as a sock knitting contest. I mean, some of the games are dreadful. The whole way the debate about scrummaging, they've got too many players. They're locked in by their own rules and their own history. They can't do anything radical because anything radical, Tony, starts to look a bit like rugby league, doesn't it? And while this opportunity exists, and it's been widely talked about, even in rugby union circles. I mean, I read this week that Eddie Jones has got his latest rugby league guy in to help him try and make England more attractive. And that's Steve Price from Warrington. Last year, it was, I forget who was spending time with them. The year before that, it was Andrew Johns was helping him out with, you know, the Lions, all this kind of stuff. We've clearly got the winning formula for the best version of the game of rugby. We need to promulgate it more imaginatively. And I don't think that having a salary cap of 2.1 million is going to help doing that. And I know the answer that would be immediately said, well, who's going to provide the money? Well, we need to have a different cadre of people involved in the management of the clubs and the ownership of them potentially, because they are the people who count.
In terms of solution, one of the things that exists in a number of sports leagues is, as well as a maximum salary cap, a minimum salary cap, whereby you have to spend a significant proportion of your salary cap, otherwise you're fined. In order to stop precisely what happens in Britain, where clubs will spend perhaps not as little as possible, but certainly not to the extent of the salary cap, and just basically have a hand to mouth existence where they bump along the bottom or mid table respectability. Do you think that would work? Given your experience at St Helens, I mean, was the salary cap or its reform ever discussed when you were at Saints?
Yeah, we did. It was discussed. I had several discussions with Maurice Lynch and Chris Casely about it, actually. In fact, I think we all voted against it, I remember, at a Super League board meeting. I think one of the best illustrations I can give you is following the mighty Saints' great win in the grand final last week, I actually bumped into someone who played in the game. And one of the things that we, quite by accident on the street near where I live, and one of the things we talked about was the current management of the game, fairly briefly, but this player made the point to me that he thought that it was shocking, and he and other players had discussed this informally, shocking that teams that they know didn't spend the full cap, and in fact had fought for the cap to be lower, and as a man who gets his living out of it, imagine he's not very much in favour of any one worker who would vote for lower wages, and that teams that are at the, as it were, the cutting edge of wanting the cap reduced and having really very little evidence of their own ambition or capacity to grow, that they were voting on the admission of new teams to the Super League competition following Toronto Wolfpack, and that it was going to be that mindset that dominated the plans for the future of the game. And if it was, this player said to me clearly, we have got very serious problems. In fact, the words he used to me were, we're in grave trouble. And I think that if people know this, but it's as if we're in this state of awful stasis where it can't be confronted because we need to arrange things differently. So, I mean, how do we get people, Tony, who want to come in and buy rugby league clubs and spend big money? How do we do that? Because modern sport seems to me, we've discussed this before, to be based on the idea now that in almost certainly all the big sports that I can think of here and on the continent, clubs are owned by either one very, very rich individual who's passionate about the club. The guy in Toulon in France, in French rugby union, transformed it, didn't he, by spending a lot of money. Or a group of rich individuals, as happens in many premiership rugby union clubs and soccer clubs, or a company. But the model we've got is of people who And I'm not knocking them, because I think a lot of them have done a great job in difficult circumstances, but who spend a lot of their time telling us that they can't spend any more because they just don't have the resources or they don't want to. I think in several cases, there's some evidence that people have the resources, but they know that in rugby league, they can get away with lowballing rather than investing. So they tell the shareholders of their own companies that they've had to support the cash flow of clubs at the time of COVID. Well, that's what people who are shareholders in companies have to do sometimes. They have to support the cash flow. But they talk about it as if it's a kind of catastrophe because they don't want to spend more money and they've got no ambition. And there's lots of evidence of that. And I don't think that that's the kind of image that rugby league needs to promote to attract more of the one commodity we desperately need, which is money. Because if we've got that, we can do lots better than we're doing at the moment.
Yeah, and I think there's another aspect to this, which is about crowds, attracting crowds, and again, the history of the game, because one of the things that you remember as much as I do, one of the things that excited people in the pre-1995 days was when a big signing was made by a club, whether that signing was from rugby union or from Australia. It was a major event, and every rugby league support, particularly the ones of those clubs involved, would walk a little bit taller because it was a way of bringing some glamour to the game, but it's also a way of making people sit up and take notice on a national scale. It's in the newspapers, on the TV. And so that ability to sign your superstar players was actually an ingrained part of the game's culture. And that's something that we've lost, partly because rugby is professional, so it's much harder to sign those players. But also, again, coming back to the idea that we've removed one of the key tools in rugby league's armoury that raised its profile and gave itself a sense of its own importance in the country as well. So I think it's, as well as attracting investors, because whether we like it or not, that's the name of the game nowadays in terms of the way clubs are financed. It also makes it difficult to not just attract new spectators, but also to galvanise and excite those spectators we need, because everybody needs a boost a bit. So, whether it was Hull KR signing David Bishop in the late 1980s or Saints signing Tom Van Vollen over in the 1950s, I mean, these are the things that were, part of the cycle.
Or Toronto Wolfpack signing Sonny Bill Williams. That really brought them to national attention in a way that nothing else they could have done. Now, we both know he's originally a rugby league player who, went to Union rather than the other way around. But you're right, the impact of signing these lads, it made everything. I remember I was working in London when Dougie Lawton signed Jonathan Davis. And someone came into a meeting that I was in very near the Bank of England to announce this, saying, "You won't believe what's happened." Everyone then was talking about it. It was, even for that 20 minutes, it was amazing. And it gave the game a sense of, almost a sense, Tony, of sort of majesty. And one of the other things that it did was it changed the balance, because people realised that Jonathan's going into a much more serious challenge now. He's playing rugby league at the top level. And I think everyone thought it was a step up, as it were, almost from non-league to professional soccer, if you know what I mean, in the same thing. He's going to face these really very serious challenges now. Let's see what he's made of. So there was the element of, will the gamble pay off, and all the attendant media attention. I remember, incidentally, when Jonathan Davis signed for Widnes, I still remember the reports on the national telly and in all the media, and they sold the ground out. I forget how they had to build temporary stands. One of the things that it proved, I think it was Dougie or Jim Mills said, well, he's paid about two-thirds of his signing on fee in one or two games. They recoup the number of shirts, season tickets, pints in the bar. It was a virtuous circle, rather than, I think, than what we've got now, when it's very hard to imagine any conversation like that. Who can you attract? There might be some great rugby union players that would be naturals for rugby league, like Jonathan was. You've made that point in the past. Rugby league provided the stage for him to show all his talents on as a great runner of the ball. Well, suppose there were two or three people we thought would fit that bill and really add a great deal to the teams, because we've got a fairly limited gene pool now. How could we possibly attract them? So in a sense, it would be more honest for us to say, well, we've given up that ambition, rather than talk about the salary cap as the way it is now, almost as something that we have to impose on ourselves, otherwise we'll all go bust. That's proved not to be true. And your point about the restricted nature of the competition is almost shocking. When you said, I think it's only four teams have won it, and one of them is Bradford Bulls. we're now playing Dewsbury in front of, you know, not very large crowd. So it's three teams, Saints, Wigan and Leeds. And I think the only other teams, Tony, that have ever been in the grand final been Castleford, Warrington and Salford and Hull. Sorry, Hull 2006, yeah. That four teams.
Well, if you compare it to the pre-salary cap days, I think it was something like 12 teams won the old championship before Super League in the same 25-year period. So, you know, you look at the evidence and you make your choice about what policy was best suited.
Have you also seen, I think I'm right in saying that I got something through the other day about the grand finals. The crowds since 2006 have diminished quite significantly. I mean, if we knew of another sport in which basically it's four teams were going to win it over a quarter of a century period, I think we'd probably sort of snigger at it a little bit and wonder, you know, not quite what's the point, but that sense of drama and excitement has been taken away. And I think the salary cap plays a significant part in that. But in this wider question of do we have an ambitious forward-looking game that's got the confidence to at least have a conversation about how it's going to grow, or are we going to slip into a sort of bureaucratic management of a salary cap? You will not attract the kind of people we need to invest in clubs if they're going to be restricted so artificially from simply saying they're going to use their wealth to buy the very best players, because that's what the speckies want to see. That's the drama of the game, is on the field, not in the boardroom.
So what about in terms of solution? Do you think it's the right way would be to simply abolish the salary cap, or raise a minimum cap, or some hybrid? I mean, one of the arguments against abolishing the salary cap is that all that will do it'll just lead to an arms race in terms of player wages, and then the whole of the game will be destabilised, which I think is the argument that was used in Premiership Rugby Union back in the 1990s, early 2000s, when they introduced one. I'm not sure there's any evidence that would happen in rugby league.
I'm not sure it's true. And if people worried that there may be, you know, this is the absurdity of the argument, really. You hear people say, well, of course, abolishing the salary cap would simply lead to the primacy of wealthier clubs. What happens now, Tony? It's funny that the teams who've won the grand final, exception of Bradford, we know what happened to them. The salary cap didn't save them from bankruptcy or insolvency, whichever it was. Leeds, Saints and Wigan, I think, would by any means be considered three of the richest, most powerful, best resourced clubs in the game. And even under a salary cap system, they're winning, because it's something to do with the way they're organised, the traditions, the history, the access to players they've got, lots of other features of that business. And I think that they would... I think a direct answer, what I would do is I would certainly bring in a minimum salary cap as part of a transitional program. I don't think that anyone thinks we could just abolish it next week and carry on, because what would happen given the current owners and their attitude to investing in those clubs? Would they suddenly spend more? They'd have no need to, because they'd know that the bottom seven or eight clubs will never, ever, probably don't even spend the full cap as it is now. So they wouldn't need to maintain their dominance, wouldn't require much more investment than it does at the moment. We've got to try and raise the levels, I think, in this transitional period, and make people understand that they're going to have to find some way of investing in those clubs, a primary aspect of which must be investing in players. Because what is the alternative? We just carry on as we are with those three clubs now dominating the competition, Warrington perhaps possibly joining the club, but they've never quite managed to do that. And when do you foresee that stopping unless we do something dramatic about the salary cap? And we say to clubs, you've got to spend a minimum amount. And there must be ways that can be achieved. It has been achieved in other sports. Other sports seem to be able to attract investors, Tony, in a way that we are finding more difficult. Look at, say, Rugby Union Club and the money they're able to spend. They don't get crowds more. They don't get crowds comparable even to Castleford.
It's part of the broader question of how do we take the game forward whilst protecting what we already have. And I think, you know, the ideas behind the salary cap of competitive balance and protecting clubs, you know, should be absolutely fundamental and are absolutely fundamental to a lot of leagues wherever you go around the world. But sometimes the accepted or traditional solutions to these issues are not the correct ones. Rugby leagues, in Britain is in a peculiar position because at a professional level it's largely locked into one particular area. But also the game has to promote and expand the professional game whilst at the same time nurturing the grassroots. And I think that's where the secret to the development plan for the whole of the game resides. How do we get ourselves into a situation where we don't have clubs like Bradford most recently going bust, or, you know, alternatively, go back even further, clubs like Oldham, which were once dominant clubs in the 1950s. How do we make sure that Oldham is saved as a rugby league area, which it still is by the skin of its teeth, and raised to a new level? And I think that it's that kind of whole of game view and strategy that we need to look at. And the salary cap is part of that because, you know, in order to get people back into the game in Oldham, we've got to have a touch of glamour. We've got to have some way of motivating and galvanising and exciting people, either traditional fans or potential new fans. And also in terms of players as well, because obviously we can't compete with the Premier League at the top level in soccer, but soccer is our major competitor, by and large, for young players in, for want of a better term, the Northern Heartlands. And if we can offer decent salaries to good players, when we have players who are talented at both soccer and rugby league at the age of 13, 14, and they're having to make a choice which game to concentrate on, well, it allows us to attract more of those individuals if they realise there's a chance they can make a, you know, quite, what, for working class kids would be an exceptional living, if not quite the superstar Hollywood celebrity lifestyle that a Premier League player can have.
You know, your point about, which, you know, I think is worth us reinforcing in this podcast, is that if the objective was to save clubs from their own financial incompetence, essentially, and to create a more level playing field, dynamic, edge of the seat, you know, nail bite competition every year, after 25 years, we'd know whether that's worked or not, wouldn't we? And we do know, because it is after 25 years, and that argument now clearly no longer holds water. I mean, if you could say to the, you know, establishment in the game, what is the justification for this? I think it's simply become part of the furniture. I don't think anyone thinks about it very much anymore, other than lowballing it. And that's clearly not going to get us out of this position where we, you know, the way I look at it is that the sporting landscape in the UK, Tony, professional sport now, is a very crowded marketplace. And it's about the broadcast deals that you get and the sense of excitement that you generate in the media coverage and all those other things. We know that we have to fight ferociously for our piece of that turf because we're barred from it in all sorts of, our history does and all sorts of other things I've done. But we're not approaching that problem with the kind of dynamism and energy that it requires. If one of the principal flagship policies of the game is that we severely restrict the earning potential of players. So we need a transitional set of arrangements, but they can only fit in, as you said, if there's a whole game approach, which we had in the past when we, for example, took the very brave decision to maintain the strength in the Heartlands, but take the Challenge Cup final to London in 1929, I think. That was a hell of a decision. You know, when you talk about Oldham, Swinton, Rochdale, that were all in the Greater Manchester area, that were great clubs, the crowds that Swinton used to get until the 60s, Test matches played there, that they are profound issues. And your point about, you know, some young kid in Oldham, isn't it very disappointing when you go to some of the old Heartland towns, you see kids wandering around in Barcelona jerseys or Liverpool or Man United or Chelsea, because they've got the glamour and that sense of just that whiff of success and colour and vibrancy that attracts a young. We can't rely on the sporting allegiance of yesteryear. In other words, we have to think more imaginatively about it.
Yeah, and I think just to round off, because we're running out of time, that you've hit the nail on the head. Rugby league has always been a combination of grit and glamour. The glamour of someone coming up from South Wales or from Australia, or as you say, taking the game to Wembley, taking the game to France. There's always been that combination. And I think the problem with the salary cap as it's constituted is that it takes away the glamour. It restricts our ability to bring glamour into the game. And that's a major issue for any sport in the 21st century when, as you said, there is more and more competition for not just for sporting eyeballs and sporting allegiance, but for right across the leisure range. So, on that note, thanks very much, Sean. As always, it's been a pleasure and an insight and a stimulating discussion. I hope listeners have enjoyed listening to this episode of the Rugby Reloaded podcast. If you want to follow me on Twitter, my name is @ColinsTony. Sean is still not on Twitter. And if you'd like to dig a bit deeper into the history of rugby and the other football codes, take a look at the Rugby Reloaded website at www.rugbyreloaded.com, where you can find show notes for this edition and also leaf through the complete archive of all episodes. So, until next week, thanks for listening.